You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, February 26, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Donald Trump arrives in Hanoi to denuke. Meanwhile, Cohen arrives on the Hill to nuke Trump. Today, a private Senate hearing. Tomorrow, a public House committee hearing. On Thursday, private hearing with the House Intel Committee. Meanwhile, Sanders explodes fundraising records. 10 million now over the first, really less than a week. Department of Homeland Security, Customs Patrol, Border Patrol to get grilled by Dems. The Senate will vote against Trump's state of emergency with the help of a few panicked Republicans. U.S. adds sanctions on Venezuela as Mike Pence insists the U.S. will stand by freedom. And Oakland teachers continue their strike. Supreme Court to take another look at that silly separation of church and state thing. Today is a special election in New York City for the public advocate. Go out, vote for Naomi Const. And lastly, the Interior Department has issued 1,700 waivers to post-BP disaster safety rules. Enjoy your seafood while you can. All this and more on today's Majority Report. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, particularly for you pescatarians.
Oh, yeah. Matt Crisman convinced me I should feel fine about being a pescatarian because we're the last generation that's even going to be able to eat fish. So,
that's right.
You know, getting well, the noms are good.
Phase itself out. And probably now, I mean, I think to the extent that we get our shrimp from the Gulf Coast, comes complete with all the chemicals you need, all the preservatives you need without having to put anything into it. That's what's nice about that.
Yeah, it keeps you young.
Michael is back from his extended vacation.
I am back, and it was great. Vieques is an amazing place, and in that top line that you just did there, I definitely feel as if I've arrived back home. There's no
yes.
more fish. Things are terrible. Trump is president.
Trump
Venezuela.
Continues to be present.
Pence, Venezuela, democracy.
We've got clips of Bernie Sanders' town hall last night, and you know the fact is he is the by really any measure the front runner, and I think you know things could change. I have a feeling there's did Jay Inslee jump into the race yet? I suspect he will. He's
not
already
officially.
Talking about the getting rid of the filibuster in the Senate, which is an odd thing for a governor to be talking about unless you're going to run for president.
He would focus on global warming. That would be his main area.
And we will talk maybe a little bit more about the protest with Dianne Feinstein yesterday. I mean, we mentioned it, and it is it's garnering perhaps maybe a little more attention than people would have anticipated. But it is, I think, it clearly is indicative of something that has struck a nerve, and because as we get closer to the potential of defeating Donald Trump, and perhaps taking the Senate in 2020, climate change is going to reemerge as an issue that we can actually do something about. To some extent, it goes away during, I mean, climate change itself does not. The urgency does not. Obviously, it grows with time. It's less of a focus when there's a sense that you have completely controlled Republican government because they will do nothing about it. Not just do nothing about it. They will actively fight against the reality of it. And as we get, now that we have a democratically controlled House, that's why that debate begins to heat up. And that's why it becomes largely an internal Democratic debate, because the Republicans are immovable on that accord. And ultimately, to the extent that climate change is going to be addressed in a timely fashion, they're going to have to be irrelevant to the equation. So the argument becomes between people in the Democratic Party, essentially, who will hopefully have a hold of levers of power, and how seriously they will take this. And that's why pushing Dianne Feinstein to swing for the fences when we already know that there's not going to be any runs scored until Democrats take control. She's up there saying, look, what we're going to do is we're going to try for a single, because I've been here for 30 years and I know the best we can do is a single. But the fact of the matter is, it's not going to mean anything either way. Everything we're doing now about climate change, every argument we're having about climate change, is for what can be done when Democrats take control. So when Dianne Feinstein says, like, I can get something passed, it's irrelevant anyways. Passing something with the Republicans today is irrelevant. The Interior Department just rolled back 1,700 or provided 1,700 waivers for safety regulations following the BP disaster. There's no part of the Trump administration or the Republican governance that is going to actively engage in climate change. So the places to fight about this are within the Democratic Party. And I guess also on The View, where Meghan McCain has a really interesting take on this. I want you to just, before you hear her take on this, I'm just going to say her name to you, and I want you to think about that. Her name is Meghan McCain.
What the hell? I love Dianne Feinstein now. I loved everything about it, and I'm in the minority on this. I really hate when people use children as political props in general. What I thought of, thank you very much, is that there was a kid named Jonathan Crone who spoke at CPAC in 2009, and he was like the new young conservative voice, and he made cable appearances, and later on, as an adult, he said he was naive. He was just saying the stuff he had heard for a long time. He also said, I shouldn't have done that speech. It was a bad idea. Later on, as an adult, and I think children have to be able to grow up and make their own political decisions about what they want. And anyone shaming Dianne Feinstein, she has been doing this 30 years. And if you don't like it, she also said in that, I won by a million vote margin. I don't agree with her politically, but she makes a lot of good points.
She's talking about basically the things you have to go through. But, you know, I would make just one point about this, because years ago during the AIDS crisis, Larry Kramer was on my show. Mm-hmm. He was the person who did ACT UP and really went after people about AIDS, medical help, etc.
Is he a child?
No, he was a grown-up, Larry Kramer. He's a famous activist. Mm-hmm. And he was going after Elizabeth Taylor. Now, Elizabeth Taylor was a pro-activist. Yeah. She was one of the champions in the AIDS crisis, and he was going after her. And I said, why are you picking on her? Mm-hmm. And he said, because if I go after the antis, nothing gets done. I can at least make a dent when I'm talking to someone on our side. And Dianne Feinstein has an incredible record on climate change. Yeah. So, yes, go to her. Because if you go to that guy Inhofe, who's holding a snowball and thinks that that makes the point about global climate change, you're going to get nothing out of it. And Trump, same thing.
I actually think that kids today know a lot about climate change, and they are the ones that are going to be directly affected by it. My kids know a lot about climate change. They know a lot about recycling, and I think you give them short shrift if you say, you know what, they don't know enough, they should keep their mouth shut. I think my daughter Paloma is 12 years old, and she could give Dianne Feinstein a list of reasons why she should vote.
And they're the ones who are going to be affected.
I don't know that they're necessarily being used as props, and I don't like the way that she engaged with them.
Well, I've been on the other end of it, as has Abby, and this is a common cheap trick. Using a kid as a prop, I never like it. I never have.
It did fit.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in other words, the two people who are sitting at that table because their dads were
politicians. I was going to say, and with that, I would like to announce that I'm leaving The View.
Right, exactly. I know Jonathan Crone. We had him on the show, actually, back four or five years ago.
A couple of months before I started, and I remember going through the archives and being like, oh, this is one of the more bizarre interviews.
I remember talking about him on Break Room Live and mocking him. And I think the problem that Megan is having is that she's finding out that on the right, they use the kids as props. And, you know, kids are used as props in all sorts of contexts. But in this instance, these kids, it really is their future. And you don't need to be a scientist to make the case that we have a urgent need to address climate change, because the overwhelming number of scientists who study this stuff have made that case. So you can just simply rely on the 97% of scientists who weigh in on this, and you don't need to be a scientist yourself. And Dianne Feinstein has probably done no more reading than I would imagine some of the parents who were with those kids about this.
Oh, definitely. And it's also just such a, I'll be on brand for a second, and I'll mention South Africa. There's the ANC Youth League, right? Like the civil rights movement was powered by, teenage and younger activists. So like, it's very funny that the conception
she's just being disingenuous.
But more broadly, there's an important point here too, that like, not only is young people in politics not a prop necessarily, it's actually powered some extremely significant things, and it's going to need to on this, because they're literally like, we are to a much higher degree than Dianne Feinstein, and if you're 14 to a higher degree than us, live on this planet that's being made uninhabitable.
Say that about the Parkland.
That's another great example.
Of course not. I mean, yeah, so these kids were like 5 to 6 years younger, but the issue is the message they were bringing is fairly straightforward. And so Meghan McCain may have issues with the way that she was used as a prop at different times, which perfectly legitimate. She should write another book about it. But
I would love to read that book.
Good for Joy Behar, too, for making the point that you protest people you have leverage with. There may be some modicum of value to protest people you have no leverage with, but it is really just more for your own well-being and to make yourself feel good. But you protest on issues where you want legislation with legislators who, on some level at least, are within the ballpark of needing to listen to you.
And all of the things
or
that
are
Dianne
supposed to at least pretend that they have to listen to you, right?
Well, I mean, Dianne Feinstein did not like to be in that situation. Even if she's not gonna run for re-election or whatnot, but the bottom line is she feels some pressure from that, because somewhere in her social circle, somewhere in her political operation, there are people who are susceptible to that type of pressure. And if she wasn't, she would have just locked the door and not had them come in at all.
Yeah.
And so they feel the pressure certainly more from there, from you know, than had they gone down to Jay Inhofe's office. Definitely. And, you know, there's a certain amount of some psychology in it. Otherwise, she just, you know, she, I mean, Dianne Feinstein can't possibly be like, I just got to watch my back as a re-election.
Dianne Feinstein also, in the ways where everybody's sort of praising her for breaking down supposedly how the world works to these kids, is indicting why the world as it is constituted does not work.
I've been here for 30 years and like, we've done nothing on this.
Incredible. The big that is the most extra. And I do have to say, this is a pernicious problem with Democratic Party leaders, because unfortunately Republicans have accomplished a lot, you know, for destruction. But you have all of these Democrats running around saying, I've worked on this for decades. Well, okay, well, let me apply a little market logic to that.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, think about your life. Think about your choices.
Folks, do you remember 1989? I do. That was the year the World Wide Web was invented. We've come a long way since then. So why does it feel like the software you use every day at work is stuck in the past? Take a leap into the future by finding the right software for your business on Capterra.com, the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 700,000 reviews of products from real software users, Capterra has everything you need to make an informed decision. Search more than 700 specific categories of software, from project management to email marketing. No matter what your business needs, Capterra makes it easy to discover the right solution fast. I don't have it up in front of me right now, but I literally go onto that site just to think about like other jobs that maybe I could get.
I remember.
Like it has
we've just discussed this. You're like, oh my God, I could manage a ballet studio.
It's true. I'm saying, you know, I don't know that I really am well suited for a ballet studio per se, but I mean, I think they have like literally they have software for every. These are just like the categories. They have like church management research, event management research, field service, HR, finance, legal, medical, nonprofit, marketing, retail. Field service. I don't even know what that means. CMS, CRM. They probably have both. Check it out, folks. Any type of software, any type of business you have. If you're thinking about starting a business, it gives you ideas based upon. And what it basically does is it's just a clearinghouse for all sorts of different software for these companies, organized in such a fashion you can find it quickly, and reviews for each one of the different softwares for that industry. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today to find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. Capterra.com/majority. That's Capterra, Capterra.com/majority. Also, as you know, hiring is challenging. Managing is challenging, too. Just keeping track of people's schedules. Very difficult.
You know that?
But there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. That's what happened to Brendan. That's how he got here. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates, so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get quality candidate through the site within the first day. We got a bunch of people I interviewed. I interviewed from that day as well as, I don't know, I think we were up for like 2 weeks. Literally. I think we had like 150 people that we looked at. And ZipRecruiter allows you to organize it. It's made it super easy. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So it was announced Well, I guess we had mentioned it and sort of teased it yesterday, but the full numbers came out yesterday in terms of Bernie Sanders' fundraising. And the reason why, you know, we're getting stuck on this for, and I don't know, we're talking about it too much, but Bernie is clearly the fundraiser. I mean, excuse me, the front runner. And the real question was going to be that I think a lot of people had, at least in some quarters, how much of Bernie's support was a function of him being essentially the only other candidate in the race with Hillary Clinton. Yes, Martin O'Malley was there, but he did not necessarily have the charisma or the foundation to make a name for himself in that race. And so the real question was, is how much was Bernie Sanders a reaction to Hillary Clinton, or how much of it was proactively Bernie Sanders? He got 43% of the vote in this, in the primary election. And look, if we had a presidential election where one candidate got 55% of the vote and the other one got 43% of the vote, that is a landslide. I mean, that would be a landslide. Now, it's the dynamics in the Democratic Party are a little bit different than the nation at large. So, you know, the Democratic Party is not nearly as polarized. And the dynamics as to why you vote for someone in a primary are a little bit different than they are in terms of a general election. But 43% of the vote, that's a lot of vote. If he could retain, the question is, how much of that 43% would he retain? Does he have the ability to build on that? Because one of the things that Hillary Clinton had in her favor was a sense, turned out to be not necessarily correct, but that she was a sure bet. She would definitely win. And a significant percentage of voters, probably in both parties, vote for someone in a primary who they think has the best chance of winning in the general election. Obviously, a certain, you know, significant percentage of people who voted for Hillary Clinton, she was her first pick, regardless of what they perceived as her ability to win. So the real question with Sanders was going to be, how much of that support would he retain on day one? And the numbers are in, and they're pretty stunning. I mean, we know what the polls say, but that's all well and good. Sanders collected $10 million from 360,000 donors. It's an extraordinary number. I think his total donor list in, if I'm not mistaken, in 2016 was 2 million. But that was over the course of a year and a half long campaign. To have 20% of those people show up on day one is nuts. And here's what's interesting about that, too. 39% of those donors used an email address that had never been before used to give to Mr. Sanders. Now, that obviously doesn't mean that there's 40% new donors. Some people, I gave money when I was in college 3 years ago, and now I gotten rid of my college email address. Or, you know, I finally got off of Hotmail, or, you know, my email account got hacked, whatever it is. There's always some churn. But even if that's half, even if 20% of the people are brand new donors, it's incredibly impressive. $10 million. And just to compare it, Sanders got $230 million in his 2016 primary. So he has already gotten about 5% of that total, a little bit less maybe. But significant portion of those people committed to almost 50,000 donors have agreed to give Sanders a reoccurring donation.
Oh, yeah. I signed up for $6 a month because I'm a bro.
Well, there you go. $1 million a month each. So there's another almost, you know, $15 million off the top. I mean, it's pretty stunning. So you start off on in the first week with already essentially having raised 10% of your total from 2016, which is it's stunning. Elizabeth Warren, 20 times what Elizabeth Warren did on her first day. Kamala Harris did a 1.5 million on their first day.
And I think a lot of the other ones, have they even released it? Because I think some, according to a piece I read last week, a lot of the candidates have not released these numbers. And presumably, they would release them if they looked good.
Yeah, and some are divined. I mean, these fundraisers have a notion. They have a calculus. They can tell what other campaigns are doing close anyways. And here's the amazing part. So there was 20 donors out of the 360,000 who maxed out. It's crazy, which means that there were officially 359,914 donors. So 359,894 can give again.
And I just want to say two quick things. One is well, I'm not going to say it's petty. I'll just say you owe me $5 from the bet with Perrine when I predicted Bernie would run, and you did not.
Yeah, all right.
But the second more important point, I think, is I think Bernie's campaign so far, and I know we'll get to it, has been, you know, I think, certainly not from like places like MSNBC and CNN mostly, but from people like Bill Fletcher Jr. as an example, there was valid criticisms of Bernie, which I think they're responding to. And I also like the idea that even that he's told his supporters like to basically be chill online,
right,
which I think is good for him. We'll get to that. But I just want to say that I guess the big takeaway, though, is like, this is also just like, listen to what people say. People are excited about this guy because of the agenda. I mean, there's a reason there's durability here.
Yeah. And I think this is at least indicative that his the support for him was not merely a reaction to Clinton. Surely some of it was, and other people are going to go to some of those former Bernie supporters are going to end up going maybe to other candidates. Who knows? I mean, the question has been how much of that 43% would he retain? Could he build on it? I don't know that you need to build on it in a race this big.
This many people. Also, it's a historical tragedy for Hillary Clinton. But I feel like she actually had both experiences, because I think in 2008, it was about like, there wasn't really any difference between her and Obama in terms of policy, but it was like, we need something really different here. And also Iraq was a really big deal, but yes, it was very stylistic. It was very generational. It had a lot to do with where you stood. And don't forget, because her campaign then under Mark Penn was, you know, they put out a memo saying like, Barack Obama, like Indonesia as a kid, save that for 2040. Like they ran on some very nativist stuff. But I think 2016 was definitely the real sign coming out of Black Lives Matter and Occupy and the living wage movements. Like, no, you got to start delivering for people.
Yeah. And I think a lot of young people who supported Obama in 2008 are supporting Bernie for a lot of the same reasons after being very disillusioned by Obama.
And I think we'll have a better sense of that as we go on. But clearly what is... I think these numbers have got to scare you if you're working on another campaign. There's just no two ways about it. I can only imagine right now what Howard Schultz is sitting in a bunker somewhere, surrounded with people who are making millions of dollars to tell him that he can win.
Saying,
soon
like,
we'll be having conversations
I've gotta do this. I've
with
do this.
Teal about like actual bunkers, and it's going to be very disturbing.
Get me now. Another double espresso. We're going to do this.
I need a thinking session.
So $10 million in less than a week is super impressive. And then last night, Sanders did a town hall. And I was watching to see, you know, because, you know, it's funny. This wasn't quite February of 2015, but it was in the summer of 2015 when two or three protesters from Black Lives Matters basically rushed the stage at Netroots Nation. And I remember there was a lot of Bernie supporters who were upset about this. And from my perspective, and I think we shared this when we were talking about this, Michael, was that this was a good thing for Sanders because he clearly had very little experience in speaking to the concerns of African Americans in this day and age. And it was early enough in the campaign where he'd have the opportunity to adjust. And I don't know. And while I think to a certain extent he probably grew a little bit in that respect, I don't know that in the context of the campaign that he had enough time to understand. I mean, I think, you know, look, he has a very good record in terms of civil rights. But I also think that we're in a different era and there's different sensitivities. And so this was, I thought, one of the best answers he gave, at least in the context of this question last night. There was another question where it was slightly addressed where I don't think he did quite as well. But this one, I thought he did very well, and I'll show you why, too.
It's an important question.
We have a question from Noella Sama. He's a policy analyst here in Washington.
Thank you, Senator Sanders. There's a deep sense of mistrust for you by some within the African-American community. Many feel you undermined Secretary Clinton after her nomination by not showing enough support, and which contributed to President Trump being elected. Along with that, many also feel that you are at times racially insensitive, and by virtue of your background, don't reflect their experience enough. How do you address these concerns, and what's your approach to winning their votes?
Well, first of all, I reject the first premise that you made. I knocked my brains out. In fact, I just saw a letter today from Hillary Clinton, which said, thank you, Bernie, for working so hard in my election. All right. We went to state after state. I think we had 35, 40 rallies in all of the battleground states. So I do not accept for one moment that I did not do everything that I could. And then people say, well, you know, some of your supporters voted for Trump. True. But some of Hillary's supporters in 2008 voted for McCain. That's the reality. More of those did that than voted for me. Now, on the second point, okay?
Pause it for 1 second. I just want to just add in here because this, and this is going to come up in a different story. Apparently, over the course of the 3 months after the nomination to the election, that would have been October, September, and August, he did 39 rallies, 17 rallies in the last 7 days of the campaign. So that's, I mean, that's pretty substantial number of rallies.
It worked quite hard for her. I mean,
but,
I,
all right,
I,
but let's just continue.
Well, people are mad that he ran it all.
Hey, that's the reality. More of those did that than voted for me. Now, on the second point, okay, we ended up winning among younger people more votes from young African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans than Clinton and Trump combined. All right. Furthermore, if you look at the polling out there, we're doing quite well with the African American community. But let me just raise an issue here. Maybe I haven't been as strong on this issue as I should be. I talk about the fact that we have a nation of massive inequality. Okay. And I believe that. I think that's the most important issue we can talk about. But within that inequality, we have another inequality, and that is racial disparity. And it's important that everybody understands that. That means that the wealth gap between a white family and a black family is 10 to 1. If you are a black mother, the likelihood it is that you will have a baby that will die. Your infant mortality rate 2.5 times higher than a white mother. If you are a black businessman, I remember talking to a fellow in Milwaukee, black businessman, said, Bernie, I can't get a loan from the bank. And his business was pretty good because of redlining. Black kids are leaving college more deeply in debt than white kids. So we have an enormous amount of disparity in wealth, in education, in health that must be addressed. And I will work as hard as I can, number one, to have a cabinet that reflects what America is, and number two, to do everything that I can in every way to end all forms of racism in this country.
And so, you know, that
perfect answer.
Yeah, and I think what's particularly encouraging about that is that, and you know, look, you don't want to give somebody a cookie for doing stuff that is sort of like baseline, but saying that he acknowledging that he could have done better on some stuff at one point. I can't remember the exact wording, but he says, you know, I could have done better on this. Acknowledging that he could do better on it and indicating, you know, that there is a specific element, whatever you believe to be the root causes, whether you believe that it's a function of class that drives racism or not. The reality, the lived reality of people of color in this country is that they may be subjected to the same class disparities, but there's a whole nother set of disparities that they have to deal with. And acknowledging that reality is, I think, crucial to, I mean, identifying them is crucial to dealing with them. And you certainly not going to happen the other way. You certainly can't, you know, not be aware and acknowledge those realities and hope to deal with them. I just don't think that's possible. But so both from a substantive and a rhetorical standpoint, that's a huge upgrade. Bernie 2.0 there is a big upgrade, and that's good in that respect.
The reason I really liked it, though, is the way, I mean, you covered obviously the most important part, but the seamlessness of him being able to totally reject the first premise of that question, which we explained.
Well, yes. I mean, it's a separate question.
Right. But it's inelegant to combine those two things. And it's actually a feat to pull off simultaneously saying that question's total BS. That other question's hugely important. And let me sort of get to it.
Yeah, the guy really pitched him a good question. I don't know whose side the DC policy analyst is on, but it worked out really well in the end.
Yeah. And I think, you know, look, I think part of the, and I don't know if the question about Clinton is meant to be a surrogate question for his relationship to the Democratic Party. But like you said earlier, Michael, he's made a point of saying, you know, show some respect to the institution. And part of the reason why I think, particularly in the context of older African Americans, I think we said this yesterday, is that the Democratic Party means something to them because of the material benefits that I think particularly older African Americans are aware of relative to, you know, their lived experience. Republicans have made it really have provided a very stark difference for particularly older African Americans in terms of sort of some very fundamental rights. To the extent that the Democratic Party, and there's certainly, you know, has not been as strong as it could be. I mean, even, you know, going back to Social Security, let's say, that stuff is a little bit more subterranean. But the Republicans have been very, very explicit in their hostility to people of color.
And even for what it's worth, like with I mean, I don't want to get into the whole New Deal and Roosevelt. And obviously, it goes without saying that there was huge compromises and racism built into negotiating with Southern Democrats, like you said. But there's also the reality that under Roosevelt, there was actually a big shift in the African-American vote towards Democrats. So even in that time, actually, yes, this was the party that on a relative scale was doing a hell of a lot better, and that was registered in support.
All right, so here's another question that Bernie got, and it is a similar question. It came earlier. And I think he didn't do as well with – he did well with part of this question – not so well with one of the premises, and so there were a couple of stories of what appeared to be narrow instances of sexual harassment on the campaign in 2016. This is every campaign, as far as I can tell, had the same problem. Clinton had someone very high placed in her campaign, I guess, who was accused of similar, but. His response here makes it clear. My understanding is the campaign is taking this extremely seriously. But there was another part, and I think he addressed that well. There was another part of this question that I didn't think he did as well.
Shadi's from Denver.
As we saw in the 2018 midterms, the Democratic Party has become more female, more racially diverse, and younger in age. How can a voter like me feel confident in your ability to represent the party, especially given that your response to sexual harassment allegations during your campaign is that you were, quote, a little bit busy running around the country trying to make the case to be elected as president?
Well, I think that quote was a little bit out of context. But let me ask you a question. I am enormously proud of the fact that we have the most diverse, progressive freshman class in the history of the United States Congress. And you know what I did in 2016 and in 2018? I ran all over this country to try to make that happen. All right? So when you talk about the political revolution, you're talking about two things. Number one are the ideas that we are fighting for. An economy that works for all, not just the 1%. But the second point that I have made over and over again is we're not going to be able to implement a progressive agenda unless millions more people get involved in the political process. So I am delighted. I am delighted. We started an organization called Our Revolution. I think Nina Turner is here. You know what the purpose of Our Revolution was about? Is precisely to bring young people into the political process. And I think we're making some real progress.
But what are you going to do, Senator, to make sure that the allegations that occurred against your campaign couple of years ago are not repeated? What are you personally going to do to make sure that...
I'll pause it for 1 second. All right, so... because he does much better with this question in terms of the sexual harassment. But the problem that Bernie has in addressing that first part of the question is, regardless of whether you think the premise is important or not, the fact of the matter is the party is far more diverse and dynamic and changing. I don't know if it's changing as rapidly as much as we're, you know, there's a greater awareness of the party being made up of a vast majority of people, you know, a diverse group of people. But he has to acknowledge that that's the case. He has to acknowledge that I am aware that when Democrats win, they lose the white vote. And when Democrats win, they always lose the old white man's vote. And we're going to have to rely on people who look like this woman to win. And he has to acknowledge the reality of that. And then simply say, and then go on with the rest. You know, there cannot be any defensiveness about that because you're not fooling anybody. She asked about, you know, about people of color, about women, and he responded with young people. And he's got to address the question. And you know, he's got to do exactly what he did later in the broadcast in response to, you know, some criticism that he's gotten in the African-American community. More specific criticism. But he's got to be able to do that because he, I think, has the confidence that his policies are going to help across the board. And the reality is he's an old white guy. And he's obviously, he's not going to get any younger. And he's not going to get any less white. And so he's got to just acknowledge it and move on. And but for, you know, day two of the campaign or day six of the campaign, I think he's in pretty good shape. And then this, I think, was very good because they have some, they clearly have a specific apparatus that they are have developed or developing to deal with sexual harassment on the campaigns.
A couple of years ago are not repeated. What are you personally going to do to make sure that doesn't happen again?
Let me tell you what we have done and what we are doing. I was very upset to learn what I learned. When I ran for re-election in Vermont in 2018, we instituted, I think, maybe the strongest protocols against sexual harassment, and that will be the protocols we bring into the 2020 presidential election. Every employee of mine in this campaign will get significant amounts of training to understand what sexual harassment is about. Anybody who feels harassed will have an independent entity to speak to outside of the campaign, and we have hired some of the best people in the country to help us on this issue. We take this issue very, very seriously.
You know, I think this is a, you know, I don't think campaigns have had to deal with this in the past. Women have had to deal with it probably the entire time. Campaigns themselves have not had any type of formalized apparatus, as far as I can tell, to deal with any, you know, employee issues like of this ilk. They just haven't felt like they needed to. And it's good that they now realize they do. And there should be formalized systems for people to deal with this stuff. And it's good. I mean, I frankly think every campaign, they should be, we should be able to go to their website and see what their, you know, obviously not the specifics, or it shouldn't be too granular, but we should see, like, hey, this is a process that we have that is institutionalized within the context of our campaign. We have, you know, some form of human resources function to deal with this, because inevitably stuff like this comes up in the context of campaigns. Lastly, what's the third clip is Venezuela. But let's go to... Let's do just Venezuela one more time. We'll finish off this the town hall, and then we'll go back to the Tucker. But right now,
the Tucker,
yeah, the Tucker, U.S. government yesterday instituted new sanctions on Venezuela. We've already had fairly crippling sanctions on Venezuela since really the beginning of 2017, instituted in part, I think, by the Obama administration. Now, it really depends on who you talk to as to whether this was the catalyst for problems in Venezuela or more like an accelerant. And my sense is it's an accelerant just because of the timing of stuff. But timed with that, I think there was also a within Venezuela private industry who also wanted to add an accelerant to this. The whole idea being that maybe they can collapse social civil society in Venezuela and weaken Maduro. Bernie Sanders has been criticized. And his foreign policy apparatus within the context of his campaign have been criticized for parroting the administration lines that Maduro is undemocratic, that he's problematic, et cetera, et cetera.
Don't forget authoritarian.
Authoritarian.
The word imperialists love to use to discredit socialist governments in Latin America.
Yeah. I mean, but I think there is, you know, undeniably a strong argument that Maduro has been somewhat undemocratic. There is, I think, wide acceptance that there were the election, his election was highly irregular.
Not his first one. So I just...
Second
his,
one, right.
His second
the re-election.
One. Yeah, yeah.
The re-election, highly irregular. There's a lot of people who argue that his move to dissolve the Constitution, also highly problematic.
He ran on a platform of creating a new constitution and won.
I would just say, I want to can I just say something really quick on this? Because maybe we can tease it out. But I would just say, like, Ava Gollinger, who I do respect and I've done a lot of stuff with, is not only is she close, I mean, she literally was a legal advisor to this government. And in her book, you know, she concludes, and she's extremely aware of what the United States is doing and some of the elements of the Bolivarian movement that Maduro has clashed with, of course, now critically supported. But she basically says at the end of the book, like, I'm not going to go into details, but, like, yeah, the corruption is incredibly deep and it's really gone off the rails, including, like, putting contracts on people. So there's actual problems there.
Yeah. So I mean,
and that's not the front burner at all of the conversation right now, but it doesn't, you know, we don't need to paint a fake rosy picture to oppose an invasion.
Exactly. Exactly. And but there so there's criticism there that that articulating those ideas, though, is you're simply parroting what the CIA is saying as a way of laying a predicate for going to war or some type of, like, various forms of either military or aggressive other types of intervention. Now, of course, when we have a sanctions regime that we have now against Venezuela, we're already being, you know, highly interventionist. And so there's some who say that it's not enough to be simply against the military intervention. Here is Bernie addressing that question, and it still won't be satisfying to some on the left, because it is acknowledging that there are problems with Maduro, and some people don't want to do that.
All right, we have another question. I want to bring in Chanel Saldana, student at American University here in Washington. She's from Pittsburgh.
Good evening. In light of the recent events in Venezuela, you came out against U.S. intervention, a contentious stance, as many in Venezuela are currently suffering at the hands of Maduro through starvation and violence, and it is clear that he will not let humanitarian aid in. Under these circumstances and moving forward, do you have a clear position on U.S. intervention overseas, both economically and militarily, for nations that are under the regimes of these oppressive dictators?
Thank you. Good question. There are a lot of awful things happening in the world, and what's going on in Venezuela is terrible. The economy is a disaster. People are living in hunger and in fear. I strongly believe there has to be an international humanitarian effort to improve lives for the people. I think the evidence is pretty clear that the last election in Venezuela was not a free and fair election. And under international supervision, I want to see a free and fair election. But to answer your question, let me say this. I am old enough to remember the war in Vietnam. And I was as active as I could trying to keep the United States from going to war in Iraq. I was in the Congress at that point. And I am very fearful of the United States continuing to do what it has done in the past. As you know, or may know, the United States overthrew a democratically elected government in Chile and in Brazil and in Guatemala and in other countries around the world. So as someone who fervently believes in human rights and democracy, we have got to do everything that we can. But I think sometimes you have unintended consequences when a powerful nation goes in and tells people who their government will be. So my view is that whether it is Saudi Arabia, which is a despotic regime, or whether it is Venezuela, I think we have got to do everything that we can to create a democratic climate. But I do not believe in U.S. military intervention in those countries.
Why have you, Senator, why have you stopped short of calling Maduro of Venezuela a dictator?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the last election was undemocratic. But there are still democratic operations taking place in that country. The point is, what I am calling for right now is
internationally supervised free elections.
I mean, I don't know how much better you could answer that question, or I should say from my perspective anyways. I mean, the idea that you can both say that, like, the situation there is bad. It is hard to get it is hard to trust international efforts now. I mean, particularly in
you cannot trust that aid convoy. That aid convoy is absolutely a Trojan horse for military
U.S.
intervention.
U.S. aid is just the CIA and has been condemned by the Red Cross for being too politically compromised.
But even, you know, even an international response now is somewhat suspect because of what took place in Libya. But the problem is...
Thank you, Marco Rubio.
Oh, yeah, it's not like one of our own lawmakers tweeted a direct threat to kill Maduro.
Right, and let's be clear. The mandate from the UN had nothing to do with regime change. And to a certain extent, we may have, by blowing through the UN mandate, destroyed the ability for the UN to sort of respond in a measured fashion in these instances. My support at the time for the Libya bombing, anyways, was predicated on the idea that the UN had determined that there was an immediate narrow threat to of a genocide, of a mass killing in Benghazi. But when the Western forces, the Allied forces, overstepped that mandate, we lost China and Russia for future attempting to stop like an imminent threat. I don't think there's anything like that in Venezuela.
Right.
Certainly there's no threat to us. Well, but I don't think there's...
No, I just think it's just... I know you're not saying this, but just because of how the propaganda machine is, it's like the harshest critique of Maduro that's based in reality is not even... It's in a just totally different universe than what was being alleged to have happened in Libya.
I don't see how anybody could look at what's going on in Venezuela as like as more oppressive than what's going on in Saudi Arabia every single day that we don't talk about.
Or frankly, more oppressive than what's being wheeled out, frankly, by Bolsonaro.
Right.
And also what's going to be more oppressive than, unfortunately, a very right-wing opposition. I mean, I think this is another thing, too, that people also just need to get used to situations where it's not like this isolationist, oh, it's over there, whatever, don't think about it. But there are definitely scenarios where there's no morally satisfactory outcome. And in some ways, the American need, I think, that like, oh, well, what's our answer to this is problematic in and of itself.
This is
because our answer is always coups and invasions and, in Latin America, right-wing dictatorship. So why don't we just ease out of this? And if you want to, as a citizen or in the actual NGO sector, try to have solidarity and support, great. I mean, people are still traveling to Venezuela now.
This was the same what we heard in Syria from like 2011, maybe 2012 for 3 or 4 years. And the answer is that just because something is broken does not mean that the United States can fix it. In fact, and this is the sort of the more sincere response to it, right? This is the less cynical version. Like, there's no intent for the United States to fix it. The intent is for the United States to have hegemony over the situation. Oh. But even if I was to take like the most sincere thing, which is that, you know, we want to help people, sometimes you just can't.
A finer point I'd like to see put on it, and the CNN town hall probably not the place for it, and I do think Bernie would be the best on this issue, but he talks about military intervention, and what about covert intervention or the CIA? Like, what about you as the president are you going to do to get the CIA under control?
Well, the real response should be, we're not going to intervene. We're not going to intervene militarily. We're not going to intervene, you know, covertly. We're not going to intervene with the sanctions regime. Now, the problem with the sanctions regime is that there may be times where you would want to use sanctions, right? I mean,
yeah, in very targeted ways. I mean, the ones on Venezuela have been unremittent and punishing, and they have tried to.
And I'm unclear, like, as to why.
Well, then they can say it's a failed state.
Well, I mean, yeah, they want
doesn't
they,
work.
I mean, there's no.
I know that, but I'm saying, like, I don't understand. Like, what is the argument that we're trying to, like, what is ostensibly the justification?
Well, the ostensive justification, even under Obama, has been that Venezuela is some like unique
rogue,
right? And that's insane. And it was obviously under Chavez. It was. I mean, it, again, not that he didn't have his problems, but. He absolutely not only won his elections, he crushed them and was hugely popular.
Was putting low-cost heating oil into the Northeast as some type of Trojan horse.
No-interest loans to Haiti and helping people in the Caribbean. And that's where people do need to look at it and be like, no, obviously that's the part where and I think actually, and I forget who made this point, it wasn't me, but I cannot recall the name. I think there is something with the illegitimacy of capitalism or whatever, you know, a certain kind of faith in our system at home, and the way Trump is going to Miami and pulling up all of this like Operation Condor years politics, because it's not just Venezuela. I mean, if they go into Venezuela, there's talk about pushing to Cuba. I mean, this is very, very aggressive.
I want that hotel.
And it has to do with that sort of getting back into that. Like, Trump supposedly always says, like, Panama was easy. Like, why can't Venezuela be like Panama? And as somebody said about the invasion of Grenada, it was great TV. And so, yeah, great precursor of Trump.
By the way, on the last election, the UN would have been there. They would have been there observing it, but the opposition petitioned them not to go because they did not want anyone to say that the election was legitimate. And also, it's really hard to find accurate information about this in the mainstream media. This is one of those situations where you're not going to find an unbiased source. So at least you should be reading alternative sources for balance.
Yeah.
Venezuela analysis and so on. But I would say, and I think, but even people who are like Greg Wilpert, who helped found Telesur and whose wife is a Venezuelan ambassador, I think, to Ecuador, you know, he'll, and is at the Real News now, but he'll say like, yeah, I mean, when Maduro didn't fix the exchange rate, that led to huge problems with capital flight and capital problems with this government. Like, you know, again, we can of course read alternatives, oppose imperialism, and the best critique inside the government comes from within, from people who are legitimately committed to that project.
Yeah,
but they're marginalized right now. That's the other truth.
Yeah, I've been trying to make this case to some of my leftist friends that Bernie is definitely the best viable presidential candidate we're going to get on this issue by a lot. While still acknowledging that, yeah, some of his tweets sucked and maybe he knows it. Maybe he's playing a game. Maybe he just needs to learn more about it. But, you know, when you say, oh, you should be letting in humanitarian aid, you're ignoring the precedent that countries that want to overthrow your government, that aid is not just aid, you know?
That was really wrong stance in my view, like substantively, but I think went 100%. But I think some people are getting really off the rails. Like when Matt Dust tweets out, the whole question of why you won't condemn a dictator is a game that Washington Hawks play to reaffirm interventionist status quo and Bernie won't play it. That's like, calm down. There's a lot of really important work being done here by the Democratic frontrunner.
Right,
like, that's a big deal. You would not have heard
to
him
have
say that
a
in 2016.
Democratic frontrunner in any campaign say we were instrumental in overthrowing the government of half a dozen Latin American countries. Right. I mean,
also the only one to speak on the Lula case,
progress.
The Democratic frontrunner.
Wow.
Progress.
Wow. So maybe one way Bernie's going to distinguish himself this time around is also by his foreign policy.
Well, I mean, he started getting definitely. Into, you know, like even like initiate, but at least his acknowledgement of the history of the U.S. foreign policy has already been sort of like a dramatic change. All right. One last clip, because this is funny because this involved Tucker Carlson. There was a hit piece that was put out about Bernie, that was a really funny piece. I mentioned earlier that Bernie Sanders attended 39 rallies in the last 3 months of, or in the general election, you know, 3 months of the in support of Clinton, 17 rallies in the last 7 days. There was a Politico piece put out that quotes four or five, one named and the other anonymous, Clinton campaign staffers, saying that ex-Clinton staffers slam Sanders over private jet flights. And the story was that the Clinton people apparently were upset because Sanders wanted charter planes. And I'll just read a little bit from this during. Okay, so according to, here it is. I'm not shocked, says this guy, that while thousands of volunteers braved the heat and cold to knock on doors until their fingers bled in a desperate effort to stop Donald Trump, His Royal Majesty King Bernie Sanders, this is a quote, would only deign to leave his plush D.C. office or his brand new second home on the lake if he was flown around on a cushy private jet like a billionaire master of the universe, said Zach Petkanis, who is the director of rapid response for the Clinton campaign, who does not know the value of subtlety when trying to sound legit. And it comes out, the Sanders campaign preferred mode of travel quickly emerged as a point of tension, according to six former Clinton staffers and another source familiar with the travel. The senator ended up flying private. It's actually charter. I don't know what the distinction is, but on three separate. Now, listen to this. Here we go.
That was such
on three separate multi-day trips in the last 2 months of the campaign. All right, so three separate multi-day trips. Prior to working out the logistics of Sanders' travel, quote, our working assumption was that 90% of the time it would be commercial, said another person familiar with the matter. If he was trying to hop from city to city in a particular state and commercial didn't work, we were open to chartering a plane. So they anticipated 10% of his travel would be on charters. They have a quote from a Sanders spokesperson saying it would have been possible to do all this. And then later in the piece, they say, okay, Sanders held 39 rallies in 13 states on behalf of Clinton's campaign, according to Jones, 17 events in 11 states in the last week alone. Okay. Forget about that.
They were literally trying to kill him.
Have some numbers here, and I did some news. I mean, I did some math, I should say, which is news because I did some math. So 39 rallies, right? Presumably, let's just say one rally a day. They had 17 rallies in 7 days. So they did two and then one day, probably three over the course of those 7 days. So there were, you had 30 days of him actually going out, taking plane travel. Now it's back and forth. So it's really more, you know, trips than that. But let's just say 30. He took a private jet on 3 days. Now, according to my math, 3 equals 10% of 30. In which case, what they anticipated, which was 90% of his travel would be commercial, actually happened. They wrote a 4-page story, ultimately, that Bernie ended up traveling by charter in the exact percentage that they assumed that he would.
Wow.
Wow.
I'd like to fly high. Put me in a socialist jet. I'll pretend to support Hillary, but it needs to be the best.
There you
right.
go.
Like if
Put
anything,
me in high planes, fly around here, take me from Vermont, any fucking where.
But this is what it's going to be. There's going to be a series of hit pieces from people who are upset or worried about Bernie, and they're all, and the narrative, you know, apparently they're going to end up having to find another narrative because that they anticipated Bernie would only use chartered jets in support of Clinton's campaign. 10% of the time, and then do an expose that shows that he used chartered jets 10% of the time is just not going to further the narrative.
Well, it's great that there are so many conflicting narratives against him, right? Because he's being attacked by the right and the center, and they don't tend to work together, those two sides. So, like, if anything, this is going to help him in the primary with people who are concerned that he didn't help Hillary enough.
Indeed. Now, the attack on Bernie for supposedly using chartered jets in support of campaigning for Hillary Clinton. Yes, he's attacked as supposedly a hypocrite to his socialism or democratic socialism, as he made a point of saying in the CNN thing the other night. But Tucker Carlson also enjoys it because it's more part of his, like, the elite are hypocritical.
This is a segment he wanted to do with Rutger Bregman.
Yeah, this is the one he wanted to do with Rutger Bregman. Where it's like, oh, he'll tell you that we have a problem with global climate change, but he took a chartered jet.
Yeah, I bet he wears a coat in the winter, too.
Exactly. Here it is.
So they say it a lot. They demand that you repeat it. They require that you believe it. They attack you if you don't. Any evidence of doubt makes you a denier. But do they themselves believe it? That's an interesting question and rarely asked. When he was campaigning for Hillary Clinton in 2016, Bernie Sanders repeatedly demanded private jet access for himself and his entourage. Over the past 3 years, according to a report in Politico, Sanders has spent almost $350,000 on private flights. How can you justify that if you believe the world is ending because of climate change?
All right, so that's the premise. And so
it's like entourage,
on...
Jeff Weaver, yeah. Bernie Sanders, Tad Devine, Jeff is Vinny. Excuse me, obviously Bernie's Vinny.
So the Tucker brought on Mark Green. I'm not Mark Green. God, Adam Green. Oh, my God.
Adam Green, like and respect.
Friend of show, head of the PCCC or co-founder of the PCCC, I think they is his title. And I think he's, I think they're, you know, Warren folk over there at the PCCC. But nevertheless, here he is basically telling Tucker, you're ridiculous, Tucker. And Tucker is having a tough time lately with guests who don't agree with him. I feel like something's going on maybe with Tucker that he's lost a little bit of, he's lost a step.
Am I hitting a wall?
The point is that if you believe that carbon emissions are destroying the earth, that's too many houses, that's too much consumption, that's too much carbon. You lead by example. Why is it the people who are trying to control my life and tell me what I can do and can't do and how many kids I can have don't bother to restrain themselves?
Again.
That's not silly. It's true.
It's silly. It's a fake hypocrisy argument. You're basically saying that, you know, if you believe that Facebook has bad privacy policies, you shouldn't check Facebook every day. If you believe you want a better job, you shouldn't
go to work. No, I'm saying if you think adultery is wrong, don't cheat on your wife.
If you believe in having a better economy with tens of millions of jobs in the future in clean energy, of course he should spend the last few days of a campaign doing everything he can to fight for a Green Deal.
No, you should reduce your own emissions. No, it's really simple.
So he should walk to work.
Should he walk from Vermont to D.C.?
Yes, yes.
Should he walk from Vermont to D.C.?
You should live by the standards. You just said yes, you should walk from Vermont to D.C.? That shows the BS argument that you just described.
Okay.
Taking
you know
a car.
What you're doing? You are making excuses because all you want is power.
I've seen you make better arguments.
That's the most amazing justification.
Look at Adam Green. All he wants is power. It's so obvious.
Just the sneering sociopath cable news star.
But like, what happened to Tucker?
Earnest,
where he
liberal like political.
This is like the, it's also like the best dressed, with all due respect, Adam, I've ever seen him. Like, this is the power guy. Like, all you want is power. That's why you decided to become a bold, you know, to start a group called Bold Progressive. Like,
yeah, and we're Target.
What happened
blazers.
To Tucker that he lost? He lost a step. Like, that's where you go to, like, after, like, if you feel completely. I mean, I always tell you this in parenting, right? Like, you don't go to like threaten to take stuff away because that communicates to the child that you have no power. And Tucker's doing that when he's like, all you want is to take over the world.
Did you hear how he shoehorned in having kids to that, too? Like, Maoist Bernie with the one-child policy.
Well, it's actually it's Green who wants to keep people from having children.
Exposing
from Vermont
you're
to
exposing
DC.
The shallowness of your own argument.
Anybody who takes any
this
plane
is idiotic.
Is idiotic? You just said he should walk from Vermont to D.C. Obviously, you don't believe that.
Okay.
Obviously, you don't believe
I'm sorry.
That. He's not a hypocrite okay. for doing
I'm
that.
I'm sorry. I can't
he
hear you.
He believes in tens of millions okay. of new jobs in the clean energy economy.
This is
What's
this
wrong
is
with that?
Idiotic, what you're saying, because, look, you will
you just
never
said he should walk from Vermont to D.C.
or your leaders.
You just
oh,
said
your
he should walk from Vermont
more.
To D.C. I asked right. if he should walk. You said right. yes. Come on. Not a real argument.
You got me, Adam. You got me. You're a brilliant guy. Thank you so much. Thank I appreciate you. It. We're going to pictures, apparently, on
that,
the screen.
But unironically.
Oh, my God. He was so mad. So mad. Unbelievable. There it is, Tucker Carlson. All right. Let's just quickly check in with Adam Green. Adam. So, Adam Green, welcome to the show. You did a good job on Tucker Carlson. Was it fun?
Thank you. It was very fun. It was a blast.
Yeah. And do you anticipate that he will have you back again?
Probably no.
Right. All right. Thanks, Adam. There you go. So we got word
look
from
power-hungry Adam Green right there.
Look at that.
It reminds me of Luke Mayville. There's a Freedom Idaho. Luke Mayville, who you know, who's doing work for
yes.
to expand Medicaid. There's Medicare
right.
in Idaho.
Medicaid expansion Idaho.
They're accusing him of leading a band of agitators on Twitter. So.
Right. Right. No.
Two
well,
scary
because,
guys.
Well, right. Because what happened was that they passed it overwhelmingly through referendum, and now the Republicans in the state house are trying to kill it, which basically subverts the state constitution. And so Luke, who like. Teaches like John Adams at Columbia is tweeting things like respect the will of the referendum.
Agitators.
Yeah,
all right, folks, I'm going to head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. And also Just Coffee. Michael, you didn't hear the story, but I visited Just Coffee last week. It was super exciting.
I hope you sent all of our regards.
I sent all of our regards, but it was incredibly impressive to hear them talk about how their mission has so much to do with supporting the farms that they buy their coffee from. They if you want to sell your coffee to a any type of enterprise, you want to sell it to Just Coffee because they actually have a whole set of other values that beyond just making great coffee. So justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Today is Tuesday. Michael, coincidentally, got back just in time for Michael Brooks' show.
I was so tempted to book a ticket that would arrive like literally just in time for tonight.
I mean, more or less, same.
Oh, well, now you're overplaying it.
More or less.
Yeah. Sure. Tonight, we are talking, of course, about what's happening in Venezuela. We're going over the cliches of foreign policy, what critical support means, doesn't mean. France, Francois is going to join us. She is a Haitian American political analyst. So we're talking about the movements that have been taking place in Haiti this week, how they intersect with U.S. foreign policy in Venezuela as well. And, of course, Bernie's in the race, this new independence group in the U.K. It's going to be a really full, jam-packed, amazing show. Patreon.com/TMBS or watch it on our freshly monetized YouTube channel. And also on the majority.fm homepage, you can get your tickets to Left is Best West Coast Fest with Anna Kasparian, Big Waz, Nando Vila, and the TMBS crew. It's our second live show at the Bootleg Theater, April 20th. Tickets are going fast, folks. Hope to see you there.
Jamie.
Yeah, so this week on the Antifada, Sean recorded a kind of triple crossover episode with some of the folks from Swampside Chats and Brett from Revolutionary Left Radio, where they talk about communization theory and what, if anything, modern leftists can take from this controversial strain of thinking. We also have an episode with Corey Pine that's out now, that is still quite good. And, you know, I don't want to take all the credit, but right after we released this episode wherein we make fun of Jeff Bezos, his dick pics, his bad labor practices, the Amazon HQ2 deal was off. So, you know, correlation, causation, whatever, you be the judge. We also have an episode coming out tomorrow with Hamilton Nolan, formerly of Gawker, currently of Splinter News, where we talk about labor organizing in the media and beyond.
And Matt.
A literary hangover most recent episode is The Unparalleled Adventures of One Hans Fall. It's an early sci-fi. You don't have to have read it because you can listen to the entire thing along with us during the episode.
Mm, sort of like a mystery science.
Mm-hmm.
1800.
Mystery science, yeah.
Nickelodeon.
Shakespeare's Globe.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell of a bank. Hell of a bank. Hell of a bank. Hell of a bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on!
Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck, fuck, fuck.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Black. Come on! Blast. Come on! Blast. Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total
pussy. Pussy, 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 pussy.
Take a leap into the future with Capterra.com, the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solutions for your business. With over 700,000 reviews of products from real software users, Capterra can help you make an informed decision no matter what your business needs. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today to find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's Capterra.com/majority. Go there, check it out. I've spent just an abnormally long time just fishing around software that just because I'm fascinated it exists.